Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on the CFPB's proposed model validation notice, how it will upend the ARM industry. When it releases proposed debt collection rule, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau included a model validation notice that collectors could use to send to individuals. But the components of the model validation notice have raised some concerns that complying with the requirements will be costly. Today, in a webinar sponsored by CompuMail, a panel of credit and collection compliance experts are here with us to share their thoughts about the model validation notice and its likely impact on the ARM industry. This webinar is being generously sponsored by CompuMail. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope everyone will spend a couple of minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. LaDonna Bowling is the Chief Compliance Officer with Receivable Solutions, Inc. She has more than 20 years of operational and compliance experience in third-party debt collections, experience in all verticals serving creditors and debt buyers. LaDonna is a certified instructor with ACA International and was named one of the 25 most influential women in collections by Collection Advisor in 2016, Who's Who in Compliance in 2018, and the ACA International Certified Instructor of the Year in 2019. Mike Frost is a partner at Malone Frost Martin. His practice is primarily focused on compliance, general counsel services, and litigation defense for the ARM industry. He has 15 years of experience as an executive at a large collection agency where he was responsible for legal, compliance, government affairs, legal operations, sales, and marketing. Mike serves on the board of directors at ACA International and is a speaker on a variety of industry topics for many trade associations. Rick Purr is a partner with the law firm of Feinman, Krechstein & Harris and a nationally recognized authority on creditors' rights, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Rick, who is a past president of ACA International, a trade association representing the debt collection industry, advises entities and individuals on matters related to compliance in the credit collection industry, including review, implementation, and auditing of policies and procedures, especially in adherence with governmental regulatory bodies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The format for today's webinar is a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net's webinar recordings page. Finally, I want to ask everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen today after today's webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation and your feedback helps to make sure that the content for these webinars is what you're looking to hear about, and the speakers, like the ones we have with us today, who are the people you want to hear from. With that, let's jump into the discussion. And first, Mike Frost, you're on my screen, so you get the honor of the first question. Let's talk about the model validation notice by answering, what is the model validation notice?
Great. Thank you, Mike and CompuMail for the opportunity to speak today. And for everybody attending, hopefully we can provide you some good information on the model notice and figure out what it is you want to do with it as a collection agency. As these rules are promulgated, essentially, really answer the question on the model validation notice. I think it was an attempt by the CFPB to try to provide some uniformity to the industry as it related to these validation notices. And I think they heard a lot from the industry over the years about the litigation that ensues on these types of letters that we send out. And I think they did what they felt was a good job of identifying the key components of a letter that need to be provided to a consumer and do that in a way that was easily understood by a consumer. So you'll notice in that model form that they provided, and if you don't have access to it, you can get it online at their website. But it does, it provides kind of a high level breakdown of the balance, things that we're normally accustomed to providing, but also includes a lot of more plain language instead of statutory based language like we've used in the past. Most agencies use, you know, the model validation notice that's provided directly from the statute, the mini Miranda that we're all accustomed to providing, various different other elements within a collection letter that we've grown accustomed to. And this is very much different than what we've seen in the industry over the past few years. And what I would almost allude to, it almost is more of a debt solicitation letter or a dispute solicitation letter than it is really about model validation notice, in my opinion. As there's a lot of statements in here about how a consumer can dispute the debt. Even the remit section has one little section that talks about the amount that they're going to pay, but you know, several different ways to check a box and dispute the debt without sufficient information, in my opinion, for the debt collector to even identify what the dispute is about. You know, there are a couple sections where it talks about this is not my debt, but you know, we're going to get a lot of check boxes that says I want to dispute the debt because I think, but nobody's going to check the next box. Those are the things that we're going to end up having to deal with as people, if these rules ever are promulgated. And you know, if we have to send up these model notices. The other question I get a lot when we talk about this model notice, and I think we'll get into this in a little bit, but I don't believe that these are being provided based under the Dodd-Frank Act, which allows the CFPB to provide proposed or model rules related to the FDCPA debt collection in general. I don't believe, at least, and I correct me if I'm wrong, anybody, any other panelists, but there's not a litigation exemption that's included in the Dodd-Frank Act, which really means that if the CFPB is providing a letter like this and we use it, then there's an absolute bar to litigation. I don't believe that exists in the Dodd-Frank Act. So if that's the case, then, you know, we are going to be tested in the courts on this language that's submitted by the CFPB. Although they identify this as a safe harbor type letter, I don't believe that will prevent the individual plaintiff's counsel from challenging these in the courts.
No, Mike, you raise a good point. And I think that there have been at least informally, if not expressed in some of the comments that were made to during the comment period, that a request that that the courts give a Chevron level of deference to the rules after they're promulgated, if they're promulgated. I mean, you know, we I guess we step back and say, look, it's been, we went through this again for the first time, you know, starting in 2013, and which ramped up to 2016, and which rules were coming. We then entered a new era with a new administration, and the process seemed to start a little bit over again. We did get finally a notice of proposed rulemaking. There was a comment period, which got extended again. There were massive numbers of comments, and then now, you know, some of the whispers that come out is you know, when and if an actual final rule is going to be put forward. But assuming that, yeah, the real question becomes, in what format does the letter that we're all looking at that was attached to the proposed rule actually mimic what we've seen already? And secondly, does it actually come out? But we've requested, I know a number of entities have requested, I know ACA has requested, if not formally, informally, that the CFPB expressly indicate that the idea behind this is to provide some Chevron level deference for the courts, because as we've seen with TCPA, you know, the courts independently determine the constitutionality, the interpretation of various statutes, and the CFPB could produce this thing. And as Mike said, we could then turn out with 92 federal district courts across the country that say, yeah, that was very nice that you put it out there, but it nevertheless still doesn't comply with, or an agency still doesn't comply with the FDCPA itself as written by Congress, even though you followed the CFPB's model form.
That's what I'm scared of from an agency and a compliance perspective, because I think that our right to collect the debt is overshadowed by the consumer's, you know, dispute options here. And, you know, I like plain English. I'm all for plain English, but here's the mini Miranda. We're trying to collect the debt that you owe to blank, blank. We will use any information you give us to help collect the debt. You know, that's not the statutory required language. And so if we go with doing this, you know, how many lawsuits are we going to have to defend? I mean, I know that's good business for a certain part of the industry, but it's bad business for me.
And LaDonna, you're right in looking at the form. I mean, if we step back and say, okay, what does the FDCPA say? We know that there are a couple things that are expressly required in the FDCPA. One is, of course, that in any communication that you identify yourself as a debt collector.
Right.
The FDCPA also requires that in initial and in subsequent written communication, you identify that this is an attempt to collect a debt, and any information will be used for that purpose. Now, they modify that a little bit with some different language. But when we go to the initial notice in 1692G, you know, G says you have to identify the person to whom the debt is owed. It doesn't say how to do that, and we could have a whole nother seminar on litigation related to how people are communicating to whom the debt is owed. You have to identify the amount of the debt, and then you have to provide what has been subject to a lot of litigation, which is that identifying, you know, what to do regarding a dispute and doing that within 30 days, how to request validation, a separate right, which has to be in writing, again, within 30 days, and how to identify or seek the name of the original creditor if it's different from the current creditor, again, in writing. So those are the major components. And then, of course, it puts the burden on the collection agency, if it receives a request for validation, which is different than a dispute, within that 30-day period, what you have to do in response and how you have to cease collection activity until you provide that response. But this validation, model validation notice, sort of turns it a little bit on its head because it doesn't identify those three things in the same way that everyone's used to, and it clearly provides a lot more in there.
So how are we, I look at the requirement that we have to, the date the validation period ends is now required in the validation notice. So how is the industry, are we going to come together for some commonality to determine when does that validation start ticking? You know, 5 days from the time you mail it, considering that, you know, typically you can get mailed anywhere in the United States within 5 days. So then after 5 days, in order to, we've got to go by receipt, and the consumer says, well, I didn't receive this until what you're calculating is day 10. You know, so how are we going to defend that?
I'll throw in a few comments, and I'm sure Mike can jump in. For anyone who doesn't have the actual letter in front of them, on the right-hand side of this model letter, there's a comment, how can you dispute the debt? And it then has a bullet point, with call or write to us by a date specific to dispute all or part of that debt. If you do not, we will assume that our information is correct. If you write to us by the, again, date specific date, we must stop collection on any amount you dispute until we send you information that shows you owe the debt. You may use the form below, or you may write to us without the form. You may also include supporting documents. We accept electronic disputes electronically at a particular point. So you're right. This section of how you can dispute the debt does two things that's different than what everyone's used to. One is it combines the concept of disputing the debt and seeking validation on the debt into one section. So instead of having two separate parts, one is disputing the debt, which in a lot of ways can be oral or written, it now just combines that with validation, which has to be in writing, in one sentence, and doesn't differentiate the two. The second thing is, as you point out, it puts a date specific in here. And as everyone knows, the FDCPA doesn't say you have 30 days. You have 30 days upon receipt, which is a mystical number that no one knows when that happens. If my agency first puts in the computer the intent to send out a validation notice. Maybe it gets sent on day one. It finally gets printed on day two. It gets into the mail on day three, and then it takes anywhere from 3 to 5 or 7 days to be received by the consumer, because depending upon where they're located and how mail is being delivered. And so the 30 days begins to run upon receipt, which may be 10 days after you started pinging your system to initiate the letter. And then if the person has 30 days and they put it into the mailbox on day 30, but it takes another 3 to 7 days to get back to you, have we not just, you know, is that within the time period, and we'd not just extend it another 7 days, meaning that the person may have close to 45 days from the time that you send the letter to get something back to you. This notice envisions a date specific. So Mike, how, I mean, you know, you worked at a large agency. How would you deal with that type of technicality?
You know, it's more problematic in my opinion. And I think you've alluded to a lot of the issues that it creates for the agency. That I go back to the days that we dealt with that, and we still are dealing with this in some capacity, are the due dates on settlement notices. You know, and the CFPB is, you know, obviously doesn't want to have arbitrary dates in a letter, and they're kind of going back to putting an arbitrary date in a letter instead of just stating what the actual statute requires, which is that receipt, you know, upon 30 days upon receipt of the notice. So I think it's one of those areas that I think if we could make modifications and improve it. And I think many of the different industry associations have put in comments to that effect as well. So hopefully we get some modifications of this form before it actually is, if it ever is, actually a final rule. You know, so you think about those dates, in my opinion, are somewhat scary from a litigation perspective. I don't want to keep them out if I can. The other thing that's really interesting about this notice too, the CFPB had another section in their proposed rules that talked about the requirement to provide notification to a consumer prior to credit reporting. And there's been a lot of discussion with the CFPB directly about that specific element, because the FDCPA and the FCRA don't require that of any data furnisher. So now that they're imposing that rule, do they have the authority under Dodd-Frank, which I think we've all kind of yelled at the top of the mountain about the fact that they don't have the authority under Dodd-Frank to promulgate that rule. But if they do, or they attempt to, there's nothing in the notice, and their form notice, that provides any information related to credit. So what are we supposed to say? And the vast majority of the clients that I have today, I won't say the vast majority, but many of the clients that I have today have experienced lawsuits related to any documentation that they put in any letter that has any reference to credit reporting. So it doesn't really matter how you state it. The fact that you put it in the letter is getting people sued. Other than the state specifics that are required in California and Utah. But outside of that, it's a highly contested litigation issue today that the CFPB is going to mandate that we put in this letter, but doesn't have any reference to it that I've seen in the model form.
Well, does that apply, Mike, to the same thing with a traditionally what we call a backer with all your state rights?
Yeah, that's possible, but there's no, I mean, again, you remember, we've seen litigation around the credit reporting statements for years, whether it was people putting statements in there with, you know, within 30 days from the date of this, the receipt of this notice, we'll update your, you know, credit bureau with whatever information. And you get sued because it's overshadowing the 30-day validation period. I mean, we've seen modifications over the last 15 years on people want to put that credit reporting statement in those letters, because I think they believe it creates a sense of urgency for a consumer to call them to try to keep it off their credit bureau, credit file. Right. So while the CFPB is mandating now that you have to provide that notice, you know, I don't know exactly how that's going to play out in the courts. And it was puzzling to me that you put a provision in the model rules that requires a notification, but then you don't put that notification or recommended notification on that specific issue in the model form. And if that's on a backer, again, that's back up to us to try to figure out what that language needs to look like. And you can guarantee we're all going to get sued on it. We're getting sued on it today. So that was one of the disappointments that I saw in this letter too, is just not having those specific elements that they're also making other separate mandates on.
What about the complete name requirement? You know, they're expecting us to, you know, be psychic and know when there's a junior and a senior. And, you know, there's really no rules about when someone is a junior or a senior and how you identify yourself. You know, we always consider, you know, the senior doesn't have to identify himself. It's the junior's job to put, you know, John Jones Jr. And then if senior dies, then junior no longer becomes junior. Junior comes Roman numeral number two. So there's so many rules around this to where there's no actual specific rules. And how are we supposed to know these things? I find that very confusing.
You mean in terms of credit reporting?
No, with the complete name requirement on the communications. Because on the credit reporting, you know, having the date of birth or social security number should fix that. Correct?
Well, yeah, in lieu of diving off topic, I think probably a lot of people on the panel and including everyone listening probably has a few complaints about lawsuits they've been involved in which you would think that providing some of that information to a consumer reporting agency should get you only the person to whom you're reporting about. But it's been a common occurrence that with file merges and other issues, that sometimes reporting that information ends up on somebody else's report as well, which is frustrating for everyone. And I know, having talked to many, you know, CRA lawyers in cases, you know, the millions, if not billions, of disputes and trade line reporting that they encounter, they would tell you it's a very small amount. But nevertheless, when it gets involved in, with your cases, it can be difficult, but it does happen. So if we look at this form again, there's a second part underneath the how you can dispute the debt, and we already talked about what some of the problems are with the actual physical date and the combination of dispute and validating, recognizing it as sort of one thing instead of two separate requests that can be made. It says, what else can you do? It tells you to write to ask for the name and address of the original creditor. Again, if you write by a date specific instead of 30 days after receipt, we'll stop collection until we send you that information. You can use the form below, or we accept such requests electronically. Said you can learn more about your rights under federal law. For instance, you have the right to stop or limit how we contact you. And then the model letter directs you to go right to the CFPB's website, www.consumerfinance.gov. It says you can also contact us about your payment options. Review state law disclosures on the reverse side, if applicable. And then, of course, it has a request to be contacted in Spanish, and it's written in Spanish.
Read it for us.
Yeah, no one wants me to make an attempt at trying to read Spanish. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I see here with a couple of them, I mean, the one thing that sticks out to me is the review state law disclosures on the reverse side, if applicable. Most of the case law out there says that if you're going to put something on the back of a letter, it's got to be done in a conspicuous manner that allows for the reader to be able to see it and recognize it, to be able to look at the reverse side or see reverse side for important information, which people usually put all caps and bolds. Here, it's in a list of five items, of which two of which are bolded. This is not, it's anything but conspicuous. So it's a little concerning to me with the state of case law and then having this here.
Hey, what about that language in that first paragraph that you just read under what else can you do? Because all it says is if you write by November 12th, it doesn't say, like, if you write by that date, it doesn't say that we have to receive it by that date. So, or am I just being too much like an attorney here? because, you know, I want to be like you guys.
Well, Mike, what do you think?
I think this is just all the ambiguity that we've seen in this letter coming out as people review it and take time to understand how to try to comply. And, you know, I'm not an advocate of putting those types of date specifics in collection letters at all, just because it binds people to specific requirements where if you have the 30 days after receipt, it just makes it a little bit more user-friendly for us and easier to be able to communicate with consumers and get the intent of the communication across rather than trying to put a date specific in it. So I'm not an advocate of either of those. The other thing that, you know, trying to shift gears here a little bit is, you know, when you think about the breakdown of accounts and, you know, our information shows and, you know, you're trying to identify, it looks like the CFPB is really trying to do, which is kind of interesting and not all bad, is identifying, you know, basically the date of the account placement. So as of January 2nd, you owed this X amount of money. You know, between January 2nd and today, you were charged this amount in interest. You were charged this amount in fees. And then you paid or were credited this amount towards the debt. So if the consumer actually made a payment in between the time that this letter goes out, and which is normally probably going to be zero because most people are initial notice of placement. Now, if you are lettering an RPC, that could create additional problems here, as well as the credit reporting notification creates problems for you on lettering to RPC. But it's interesting to me that they're breaking these out and they didn't get into any more detail. Because I know there's cases out there today where, you know, you've got to say that there is no safe harbor language in this letter either, which kind of caught my attention when you're talking about interest. There's no Miller language. We also have no collection fees that are identified. You know, is that going to just drop into the amount in fees? We've seen that in litigation as well when you're not identifying exactly what the fee is. So there's some questions there. The other piece that is a little bit troubling to me is most of the agencies, and I mean, we're debt collectors first, right? We're trying to comply with all the regulations, but the first and foremost, there's nowhere in this letter other than contact us about payment options, which is dropped into that section that Rick just read. What else can you do? There's nothing in here that asks for a payment, nothing in here that asks for money. So we're supposed to be sending an initial notice to a consumer with these disclosures and a million different ways that you can dispute the debt, but we're not supposed to ask them to pay their bill. The other part is the only place that I've seen other than the CFPB's own website that Rick pointed out and the website where a consumer can dispute, there's a small website that you can put up there underneath the kind of the company's address and stuff and hours of operation. Most agencies are utilizing some type of icons that drives a consumer's attention to, you know, different forms of payment or different ways that they can make a payment, one being a website. So that's all going away too. You're basically going to have that one little website up at the top, which from my perspective, when the CFPB tried to, I think in their proposed rules, allow us ways to be able to communicate in the manner that the consumer would like to communicate. But then in this model form notice, there's not a whole lot of emphasis on self-service through a payment portal. And that was a little troubling to me too, with that not having a little bit more emphasis there that allows, you know, consumers to, I think the millennial phase, everybody knows very well that they would prefer to speak to even a voice bot than a human, would also rather go visit a website to make a payment than make a phone call. So why not have that as a more prominent option to drive consumers to communication channels that are of their so choosing? And there's nothing in here about text. You know, could we have them text, you know, a certain number to get a text message back? I mean, those are the things that they're suggesting that they're very interested in, yet this model form notice didn't have any of those types of references, which is just interesting in my opinion.
One of the things, and you raise a great point, Mike, on that, what that discussing what is for anyone who's not actually looking at the document, the left-hand side, if you imagine two columns, the left column right below all the headings where it says our information shows, it then has a statement, you had a Main Street department store credit card from Bank of Rockville with account number 123456789. Which you know, is at least an effort to try and identify, to use the commonly known information that a consumer may have about the obligation they possessed, i.e. a Main Street department store credit card, or, you know, what you would throw in there is a Home Depot or PayPal credit or something like that, from Bank of Rockville, who is supposed to be the original creditor, or at least the current creditor, with an account number, which is the original creditor's account number, different than the reference number that's put up in the top right-hand side of this form. But then it goes through with, as you identified, as of the date of a certain date, you owed blank. And then between that date, which on its face appears to be the amount that was originally assigned to the collection agency, although we're not 100% sure. It then says between that date and today, meaning at least in some cases several years later or otherwise, you were charged this amount of interest. So there's the accrual of interest between the top and the next. Then it has you were charged this amount in fees, and it doesn't identify what fees that is, collection fees or otherwise. And then lastly, you paid or accredited this amount towards the debt with a minus sign, and then says now the total amount of the debt now, and has a total. But you raise some great points, which is, one, what if the interest is zero? You know, do you have to follow this model form? What if there are no fees? What fees actually go in there? And if interest is accruing, you've identified nothing in all the litigation that we've seen, which is, you know, primarily in the Second Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, which is about accrual of interest and safe harbor language, all of which is absent and opens up a lot of questions about, you know, can you, in this, with what we started with, can you get sued based on not putting information in the letter that current case law says you got to put there?
How are we going to carry this expense of getting this information from the creditors to the agencies, you know, and then getting it mapped to the letter vendors?
Yeah, and then to open another can of worms, it seems like that's all I'm doing today. And I'm not trying to be overly critical of the CFPB's proposal. I think the intent's good. I think where I'm struggling too is when you look at all of these different requirements and these interest calculations and the breakdown of the account, and then you think there's nothing in here that really identifies medical debt. And medical debt has sometimes six or seven different debts, or even more than that, that you're trying to provide information to a consumer on in a letter. Because if you don't, they're going to get six or seven different letters. And what's more confusing, one communication with information in it related to the debts that they owe to a specific collection agency, or six or seven letters that are coming from the same agency with different debts. I don't know.
I don't think you're being critical. You know, yeah, I certainly don't think any of us are being critical, because I go by, you know, once bitten, twice shy. You know, we have to look at this from every angle, because, you know, this is what we do every day, and we got to make sure that, you know, we're completely legit and we're mitigating risk for our shop.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, back to that issue, I mean, what are we going to do with medical debt or any type of debt that is multi-debt debtor placements? So, you know, if you've got multiple debts to actually provide in here, I don't know how you would actually conform your new validation notices with the model form from the CFPB. So does that mean that we all have to go back to, you know, individual notices for each debt? I'm not sure. I don't know that I have the answer to that. But, you know, if I'm plaintiff's counsel, everything that is added to a letter that's not assessed in this model form notice is going to be up for grabs, you know, and they're going to probably test the waters as soon as these form notices come out. So, you know, while I think the intent's good, and the intent is to try to lessen the burden on the collection agencies and reduce the overall risks of litigation, I think it probably will do the exact opposite, in my opinion.
I just want to jump in for a second and first thank our panelists for doing such a great job so far. I really appreciate it. Remind everybody, if you want to ask a question, type it into your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll try and get to it before the end of today. But now I did want to take hit the pause button and briefly say a few words about CompuMail, the sponsor for today's webinar. CompuMail is pleased to be sponsoring this webinar about a topic so vital to our business and to the success of our clients. Since 1994, CompuMail has been delivering dynamic communications and services to customers around the U.S., specializing in the accounts receivable, financial, healthcare, automotive, and public sector industries. As a trusted full-service outsource provider that is 100% privately owned, CompuMail is large enough to meet the unique business communication needs of our clients, but small enough to ensure that each client is treated with care. CompuMail understands how critical safeguarding your data is, which is why we ensure your security with the industry's best compliance and certifications available to exceed the industry standard. Please inquire on how CompuMail's expert team partner can assist you with the seamless integration of your communication strategy across multiple channels from design to delivery. You can learn more at www.compumailinc.com. Thanks to Stephanie and Jana, who are with us on the webinar today, for your sponsorship and your continued support on what is a very important topic. Okay, let's get back to our discussion. Let me kickstart things off. There have been some comments, especially among those that were filed with the CFPB, about the expense of complying with the model validation notice as originally proposed. Are there going to be ways, or do you envision ways, there being ways for agencies to keep costs down if the validation notice is not changed under the final rule? Does anyone want to go first?
This is Mike. I'll just pick up where I left off there, which is, you know, that medical debt or multi-debt placements. And I think that's going to increase the expense for agencies that are dealing with this. The other thing, there was a anonymous attendee here that made a statement in the questions section that asked, where do we actually put the state notifications in the small space, you know, to the left underneath the our information shows section? Or do you put it on the back, like Rick alluded to earlier with the statement that the CFPB puts on there? You know, that adds additional expense too. And while it's not, it doesn't sometimes feel like a huge expense adding the second letter, and it probably seems nominal to the CFPB with the margins that agencies and the pressures that they're under today with costs, you know, that every penny, especially when you're doing it in mass volumes with, number of placements that you get annually, extrapolated by the cost associated with sending this letter, adding a second page is going to increase that expense too. So those that are using conditional statements today to drop in the state specifics on the front are now going to have an added cost to have a state backer associated with the account for all the state specifics. So I think, you know, to answer your question, I don't think the costs are going to go down at all. I think if anything, we're going to probably see an increase in expense for agencies to be able to comply with this.
And if you look at the form itself and the spacing on this one-page form, you know, and imagine the font size, but I think that many agencies do a really great job of including information in a way that allows for more information to be provided. So, for example, we were talking about medical debt before. You know, this letter may be great if you have a singular credit card account from a particular branded credit card. But if you're dealing with a hospital, or you're dealing with a medical provider in which the services, maybe there's six or seven different services that were done, and they, you line item them, and you specifically put the date of the service, how much this one was, and you put it all together because you're getting the debt at the same time, but it's multiple different levels. There's no room to put that here as it currently stands. You can't break it out. You can't put that.
And, you know, some states have requirements on how large your font is supposed to be. And how do we work all that into here? Because, you know, I know this is just an example, but I just don't think that it's going to go well. I appreciate their efforts, but I just don't like the way it reads.
You know, and I think Rick's point about the medical debt and the kind of the breakout is what the trade associations provided commentary back to the CFPB on as well. You know, there's difficulty, and I there's questions around medical debt and you know, to Rick's point, when you have multiple different service dates, you have multiple different creditors even, because not all of the hospitals roll up under the same name. They may have a different anesthesiologist name than they have of a hospital name. And we try to, as debt collectors, provide that information to the consumer so they can completely understand exactly what debt that they're dealing with in those letters. And to have them all together has been seemed to be useful for consumers, because they can look at those dates of service, they can look at the different creditors, and they probably can match them up to bills that they received. It makes some sense with, you know, with what we're attempting to collect. Doing this again, we're going to be killing a lot more trees and sending a lot more. Maybe it's an attempt to increase the financial wherewithal of the USPS. I don't really know, but you know, instead of sending one notice with 15 different debts in them, I mean, we may be forced to. Not saying that this is absolutely a requirement, but we may be forced as agencies to actually send out 15 individual validation notices. And again, you know, trying to keep small businesses in mind when they were creating the rule, I would have hoped they would have thought through some of these multi-debt issues that we're going to experience with this model form.
Let's look at underneath the fold, so to speak, where they have the model perforation, and then you look at the tear off ticket that you're supposed to put in an envelope. Of course, presuming, of course, that your envelope actually reverses where the return information is and where the mailing address is, because it seems to be on this form that they haven't provided you with a cutoff ticket that you could physically fit the right way into how the modern envelope is written. But aside from the placement of that information, you know, the right-hand side says, how do you want to respond in bold letters? It then gives you really four options. It says, check all that apply. So you could do more than one thing. Check number one is, I want to dispute the debt because I think, and we'll go over what it says underneath later. Number two, I want you to send me the name and address of the original creditor. Three, I enclose this amount, allowing them to write in something and identifying how to make the check payable. And lastly, the request to send the form in Spanish, which again, I will not attempt to read. So if you go back to the, I want to dispute the debt because I think, it provides you with, again, three sub options. This is not my debt. The amount is wrong. And third, other, please describe a reverse or attach additional information. And it doesn't provide valid, it's not a request for validation. It's really, I want to dispute the debt. There seems to be situation in which they are not differentiating between the FDCPA's actual distinction between a dispute and a request for validation. And of course, send me the name of the original grant. And thirdly, enclose the amount, which is what Mike was saying right from the beginning, which is that this really isn't a letter requesting payment. Payment is hidden deep in this column. Payment is hidden on the top portion of it, at least expressly. So what do you think about this section?
It's overshadowed.
Yeah, payment is overshadowed.
So if someone checks here, you know, I want to dispute the debt because I think this is not my debt, and then they also check, because it says check all that apply, I enclose this amount, and they enclose a check for the full amount, but they're also saying they dispute it, and so do we post that money?
I would think so. I would think payment trumps everything.
Really?
Sure. Okay. They don't have
all right,
to close
you sound
the
like
money.
A debt collector.
the other thing is that creates issues for us here, and I think we alluded to it a little bit earlier as well, is, you know, a lot of people are going to check that box, I want to dispute the debt because, and then they're probably not going to check the other boxes, or if they check other, are they really going to attach any documentation or provide an explanation of what the actual dispute is? So we're going to, you know, as agencies, we're going to get these documents in that is a formal written dispute. And is, you know, we have a duty as a data furnisher to update any of that information that we may have at the credit bureaus, and we're required to investigate any dispute, correct? If that's the case, then how do we investigate a dispute that just says I dispute the debt but doesn't give you enough information to understand what they're disputing or what portion they may be disputing of the debt? So there's going to be some issues that people are going to run into as well when you get these check boxes, not enough information to really understand what to do with it. and then try to make sure that you're following your policies and procedures to ensure you're following the FCRA as well, if you're reporting the accounts already. And I think most people that receive a written or verbal dispute from a consumer after the 30-day validation period are acknowledging those and doing an investigation and still adhering to that, even though it's not within that 30-day limit. So, you know, I think that also creates a negative for consumers, because what option we may have to rely on is to go back to that 30-day requirement, which is not what the intent and is not in the best interest of the consumer. So I'm not really sure that this gets us where we want to go.
Look, Don, let me ask you, the currently your agency, if you just get a letter from the consumer that says, I dispute the debt, it doesn't do anything else, are you treating it differently than a request for validation?
Yes and no. I mean, okay, well, to answer your question, if they say they dispute it, we go back to the client, get validation of the debt, and send it out to them. And of course, we update the credit bureau if we're credit reporting.
So you are kind of treating a dispute like a validation request.
Yeah. Unless they get very specific with what the dispute is. You know, I paid this to the prior agency, you know, check crossed in the mail, then of course those would be handled a little bit different. But if they're just being generic with it, we get them validation and send it back. You paused. Is that wrong?
Well, no. I'm curious about that. Just seeing how practically that impacts it. And what if your agency, that you go back to your creditor and the creditor says, they never paid. Or what are you doing with the, how are you treating the dispute? Are you still continuing collection activity, or are you just returning it?
No, we'll validate it to the consumer, and then we'll have someone follow up with we have a dispute resolution team that follows up on disputes, some disputes, not all disputes, because some of them, you know, we're like, that's too risky, and, you know, just either close and return it or continue to report it as a dispute. But, you know, it gets complicated because this is one of those areas that, you know, is tricky, you know, from an operations perspective and how you handle them. And if we could just get a little bit more specific information from the consumer, you know, the amount is wrong. Okay, well, why do you feel like the amount is wrong? You know, you paid it, your insurance wasn't filed, you know, give me something to go on here.
So does this, how do you want to respond, give you enough to do those things?
They can give more information, but they're not, you know, please under other, you know, please describe on reverse or attach additional information. They're not going to do that. I think if this is not my debt, you know, why do you say this is not your debt? You know, the amount is wrong. You know, why do you say the amount is wrong? They need to get specific. Otherwise, we're just going to be, you know, pushing paperwork. You know, stopping the collection process, you know, going back to the client, and just, you know, labor intensive, and it really suits no purpose other than to say we're adhering to the law. In the end, I don't think anything really gets resolved to anyone's satisfaction. You know, typically the account doesn't get collected on, and is the consumer really satisfied that his dispute is being handled? So I think it's more consumer friendly if we give them more avenues to be more specific to us so that we can truly help them. You know, if that's the objective of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, then, you know, give the consumer options so they can get their problems resolved and not just create a paper pushing exercise. Sorry, I get a little excited sometimes, fellas.
So we've talked about a lot of things that we don't like about the letter. I'm going to steer the topic of to a couple big ifs. If this letter is actually a safe harbor, what do you think the impact would be on its use versus current consumer litigation over a period of time, assuming that a court will uphold this as a safe harbor? What do you see?
I'll I just see that they'll find something else to focus on.
So, and for me, you know, I'll go back and argue that collection letters probably don't collect a lot of money. Collectors collect a lot of money. You know, so maybe it won't have as profound impact on the business and the liquidity rates that we may think it may have. So if we're, you know, true believers that collection letters are more for providing disclosures and the required statutory mandates, then maybe this is a positive for us because we can do it without being sued. Now, this is really an initial notice. I don't think it's templated out for any subsequent notices. So could you still send your settlement offer letters later, which I think, collection operations would argue that settlement letters have a good impact on recoveries. Again, you're not going to have, you know, the safe harbor, but at least you would in that first initial notice where we see a lot of the overshadowing arguments and the discussions between, or the arguments from plaintiff's counsel that, you know, suggest that the validation notice wasn't provided timely or was provided inaccurately or provided, you know, different ways and the interest calculations and all that, all the stuff that we've seen in litigation over the years, maybe that goes away, at least in the initial notice, and that would be a positive element. But again, it goes back to that belief of whether you believe collection letters collect money or not. And, you know, some agencies that I've, you know, seen in the past had very, very structured collection letter processes, and they believe that collection letters were kind of the fortitude and the main foundation of generating liquidity. So you take a lot of that away from those agencies to be able to define themselves differently than some other agency that may be more believers on using the phone and speaking to consumers to try to recover those balances due. So I think it kind of ties the hands of the agencies a little bit, but if there is a silver lining there, if that was true and we didn't see the litigation, at least for one letter, it may be a good option just to at least get the validation notice out the door and to the consumer and qualify under that specific requirement.
You have a talent for taking us down the dark road and then bringing us back into the light. Thank you, Mike.
I don't think. Well, thank you for that. And I hope that I don't believe I'm ever going to be a preacher, if that's what you're getting at.
No, I'm married to one. You're not.
Good.
I mean, I see a lot of, I'm sure, Mike, you see it on the legal side, and LaDonna from the agency side. You know, I see a lot of letter litigation over what I will call very simple, mundane things that really shouldn't be litigation, but even courts are buying into the fact that there's a case, so you don't win a motion to dismiss. That if there really was a true safe harbor, the elimination of could be 20-30% of all cases out there could just go away if you couldn't sue on them, because it's everyone's had them. You know, I sue because of the interest disclosure language. I sue because it's overshadowed. I sue because you actually use validation language that they say is illegal, even though it's in the statute. I sue because the font size was too small. You know, those are some things that you see out there that I'll call unforced errors. They're really nothing that anyone did wrong, but it created that cottage industry. And to the extent that we can get a safe harbor, you'll see a lot of litigation costs, even though it may not be the letter you want to send out, at least the initial one. I see, you know, people saving a lot of money on legal fees and meritless settlements over the initial notice, which is probably the bulk of why people are sued.
Yeah. Well, from a collection perspective, I don't like it. Again, I think our right to collect the debt and ask for payment in full is overshadowed by everything else. If they changed how things are oriented on the letters, on the letter, like at the beginning of it, you know, this amount is due, here are your payment options, and then below that, you know, what can you do if you don't recognize this or if you don't do this? But you know, we're debt collectors. We're here to collect money. And that little blurb at the bottom, you know, I enclose this amount. That does nothing for me.
I guess that gets back to Mike's question about whether do letters collect debt, or are there other ways? And
I think they assist if used strategically. You know, that shouldn't be your go-to, you know, to rely on, but I'm with you. You know, collectors collect the money, but a good letter strategy can also help you.
And I know CompuMail would definitely agree with that.
Absolutely.
And I'll go back, just, you know, I know we're kind of running out of time here, but, you know, the biggest thing for me was this, you know, speaking to consumers and in the preferred methods that they want to communicate with us at. And I don't know, I think we missed the boat there, or the CFPB may have missed the boat there, because there's not a lot in here that talks about those different communication methods. And to you know, reduce what we currently have, and most collection agencies have, you know, this prominent opportunity for a consumer to self-serve through their website, you know, and to limit the ability to do that in this model notice is a little bit disconcerting too, because I think we're going to see over the next few years and is a big shift in communication, and I think everybody sees it. It's nothing new. It's not like wow, that's a great idea. I've never heard of that before. Omnichannel communication comes up every single time people are talking in any webinar. And I think it needs to be addressed in these model form notices as well, because we need to be pushing consumers to text. We need to be pushing consumers, maybe not pushing, but providing options for consumers to be able to communicate with us and all those different omnichannel communication methods. And here you have one little reference to a website and phone number, and you can send this remit back, of course, with your dispute checked. Outside of that, it's not providing those options, and I think those should be included.
Excellent. Well, we do only have a couple of minutes left, but before we wrap up for today, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of you a chance to share any parting remarks, summarize what you think are the most important points today, address something you didn't get a chance to talk about just because the conversation didn't go that way, but you still want to mention, but just to share any concluding comments that you might have. LaDonna, would you mind going first?
Oh, thank you. Well, even though I'm not a fan of this letter, there are some things about it that I like. All hope is not lost. This has not been passed yet, but, you know, review it and look at, you know, start thinking about how you're going to incorporate this into your business model if this does get passed, and, you know, what you're going to do about it. And that's really all I have to say. I was glad to be on this panel with these two fine attorneys. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Mike?
For me, it really goes back to, this is a safe harbor, assumably a safe harbor. I think that's the most important piece to understand, is how is this going to play out? And what's it going to mean from a litigation exemption perspective? And if I don't have a full litigation exemption by utilizing this notice, maybe I take this notice, but maybe fill in some blanks. Maybe I do focus more on how I get to communicate with a consumer in the format that they prefer to communicate with, and things like that. So are you going to have it exactly like this letter? Maybe not. And if there's an opportunity here to revise some of this before the rules are promulgated and get the CFPB to understand some of these concerns, maybe we can get them to make a few additional changes. I think they're open to that. They've been very open to try to find a balance between the consumer's needs and the needs of the collection agency. So hopefully we can provide some additional influence through our comments and continue discussions with them. And if the rule is ever promulgated, hopefully there's a few modifications to it. I wouldn't go changing a letter today if it was me.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you very much. Rick?
Thank you, Mike. And thanks to all of my fellow panelists for the opportunity to talk with you about this. I think it's, when we look at the letter, you know, your first glance was when the notice first came out was great. You know, we've been asking for model language, whether it was a model voicemail, whether it was a disclosure, and in this case, a letter that would provide safe harbors for the industry. When you get down to a little bit more of a deep dive on the letter, you start to see a few flaws with the letter that really come out. But I think at the end of the day, if one, as Mike noted, there is a safe harbor that's applied, the benefits will outweigh the negatives about this letter. And that may take a little bit of effort if the CFPB doesn't expressly note it, but I think it's their intent. Secondly, is that a lot of the comments and a lot of the issues that we've raised on this call and that many of you see from looking at this letter have been brought to the Bureau's attention through the comment process. And if you look through the comments and the hundreds and hundreds of comments that were at least filed on behalf of industry participants, you see a recurring theme when it comes to this particular letter about some of the flaws in its format. And we can just keep our fingers crossed and hope that as the Bureau continues to take informal information as well as the formal comments that were made, that the final product will have some of these objections addressed in a way that makes it more user-friendly for the agencies and the everyone that's involved on the ARM side. But I think that something like this is here to stay, and we need to work around it. We'll probably have to face a little bit of litigation over its usage, but a few effective court opinions right out of the gate could put a quick close to consumer litigation over this letter shortly after its release. So appreciate the opportunity and the call, and we'll wait to see and keep our fingers crossed about what we ultimately see in a final rule.
Well, excellent. Thank you. LaDonna, Mike, Rick, thank you guys so much for your insights and your time today. You guys were awesome. Really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and perspectives just for the betterment of the industry. I can't stress enough how important that is, and I think all of us who are listening, I'm sure, are applauding as well as I am. So thank you very much. That was awesome.
Thank you.
Everybody else, thank you very much for listening today. Again, I want to thank CompuMail one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.compumailinc.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar. And definitely feel free to share any topics or speakers that would be of the best use to you going forward. A recording of this event will be posted later today to accountsrecovery.net webinar recordings page. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day.